This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
Welcome to another edition of Danny in the Valley. Thank you for tuning in or downloading or whatever the best term is. We have a great guest this week. Phil Libin is here. He's the founder of Evernote, the note-taking app that became a unicorn way back in 2010. Before the term unicorn was even really a thing. He's just launched a new company called All Turtles, which is all about riding the next big wave in technology, artificial intelligence. Soon, it's going to be everywhere. Anyhow, Phil is a thoroughly human tech tycoon, if I can call him that, and he has some great insights from 20 years in the startup trenches. I think you'll really enjoy it. Without further ado.
You're in All Turtles Galactic headquarters right now in San Francisco. We're an AI startup studio. We're launching in San Francisco, Tokyo, and Paris right off the bat.
And so is this effectively like kind of like an accelerator?
Well, I think incubators and accelerators, you have to ask, like, well, what are you incubating? What are you accelerating? And those are trying to make companies. And what we're doing is we're saying we don't really care about companies. Like, we actually think that part of what's wrong with Silicon Valley is this, like, fetish around companies. We want to make products. We're product first. And some of those products become companies and others don't. And like, that's fine. We want to focus on having really talented product people making products without forcing them to like go through the motions of worrying about company stuff before they've like made their products. So we're not necessarily early stage. Like, we see ourselves as a studio where we make stuff in the same way that like HBO does or Netflix does. Like, those aren't incubators or accelerators. Yeah, a lot of great things come out of them, but they make and distribute stuff. We do the same thing. Instead of making TV shows, we make products.
So you'd be like a Hollywood studio and you're hoping to produce a lot of blockbuster products like chatbots or what?
Well, you know, blockbuster is actually an interesting thing. Most of the money in the new studio model isn't actually aimed at blockbusters, right? It's really more like these like medium-sized shows that have like a loyal viewership and a good audience. And actually the old style Hollywood system like that existed like in the 80s and 90s where they were all geared towards giant blockbusters, those were pretty crappy businesses. Like, all of those studios were constantly going bankrupt every few years. What we were actually trying to do is we're not focusing on the blockbusters because companies, like, we're not trying to make decacorns. Like, we're not asking ourselves before we start working on something, we don't ask, could this be $10 billion, which is what every VC asks. We don't ask that. We don't care. A, because there's lots of really worthwhile products that shouldn't be $10 billion or $1 billion. There's plenty of things that maybe they're $100 million, and that's still a great outcome if it's good for the world and it's good for the founders. And so we want to build a lot of those. But B, because it's impossible to predict ahead of time what the $10 billion outcome is going to be. So we actually think we'll have just as many $10 billion outcomes, which is to say very few, that everyone else has. But sometimes it'll happen. But we don't try to anticipate. We don't try to filter for those. We just want to build worthwhile things.
So you've been at this now for 20 years.
Yeah, at least, I think.
Perhaps it's worth stepping back and just going through a potted history of Phil Libin. Because you're from Leningrad, correct?
Yeah, back then it was called Leningrad. Yeah, St. Petersburg now in Russia.
And is Libin short for, was that truncated from Libinsky or something? Or
I don't know. It's been Libin for at least a couple of generations. Okay. So I don't know. It feels like it was something else before, but I have no idea. I'm deeply incurious about my own family and background, so I've never actually bothered to ask. But it's been Libin as long as at least my father's been alive.
So when you came here from the what was then the USSR in...
1979. I remember watching on our little black and white TV with my dad, right when we got to the country. I remember watching the dream team, the 80s Olympics when the U.S. hockey team beat the Russians.
Yes.
That was one of my first memories in the U.S. as we watched that live from our tiny little rat infested apartment in Brooklyn with a little black and white TV.
And were you, whose side were you on
that? So that's the thing. So I fundamentally was born without the gene that makes me care about sports balls. So I just don't understand anything having to do with sports at all. But I remember walking into the room and my dad was watching this TV, and then, the game ended and he was really, really excited. And he said, we won. And it was the Soviets playing the US. And I was a little bit confused. I'm like, who's we? And he's like, the Americans, of course. And it was actually my first patriotic moment. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess we just got here, but I guess now we're the Americans. And that actually felt pretty good.
Right, we've switched sides.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the Bronx?
In, a pretty rough neighborhood, but it didn't matter since I was such a computer nerd. I just sat in my room and played around with my various computers. And then went to school in Boston and then started a couple of companies there. And then moved to California for Evernote about 10 years ago.
And you experienced the delights of government cheese growing up, is that right?
Yeah, so my parents in the Soviet Union were both classical musicians. You know, confer some amount of social status over there. It was kind of a prestigious thing, didn't make any money, but it was at least prestigious. And then when they moved here, they couldn't get jobs as musicians. Didn't speak English and they were in their mid-30s. And so they wound up taking a series of, relatively menial jobs just to get by and then kind of work their way up into the middle class. But we were always fairly poor growing up. We were on welfare. We got the government cheese, for a few years. Never to the point where I ever felt deprived. We always had food to eat. But yeah, it was definitely a lower class than going to lower middle class than kind of going to middle class upbringing.
And so how old were you when you started your first company?
I started my first company in high school, so I must have been 16. A friend of mine and I started this company where we bought computer parts. We ordered PC parts from Taiwan from a mail order catalog, and we assembled it ourselves, and we resold the PCs to local businesses. And I sold that company for $500. That was my first exit.
$500?
$500. It was 500 big ones.
Wow, at 16, you must have been...
I was set. That was a good. That was a solid sum. The way I remember thinking about it, I'm like, this is how much money I would make all summer working at Carvel Ice Cream. Yeah.
And then after college, you started your first.
Yeah, my first sort of real company was Engine 5, which we started in 1997.
And I spoke a few weeks ago. We had Marco Zappacosta on from Thumbtack.
Yeah,
and he's great. He talked about growing up in an entrepreneurial family. His parents started Logitech, etc. Yeah. And he talked about how important that was to actually see that it was possible, especially because he kept getting all these no's and kept running into walls and it looked like it was going to be impossible. Did your upbringing kind of give you something that made you think that you could actually do this? Because, you're on number five. Well, if you count the computer company, number five.
Yeah, let's not count the computer one, so I'll say number four. No, God, no. No, I was totally unprepared. My family was anti-entrepreneurial. You know how some people say I'm the first person in my family to ever go to college? I'm the first person in my family going back many generations to not finish college. Everyone in my family is a classically trained musician or a PhD scientist or a poet or a chess master or something like that. It is a very brain and talent heavy family. I am the black sheep. I am the person that just couldn't get my together enough, so I had to,
start
companies.
So you just had to found and sell a bunch of successful companies.
Well, it felt like failing for a long time. It felt to me like I was doing this because I couldn't keep a respectable job. I was probably on company number three before I realized, hey, this is actually a somewhat reputable way to make a living. So yeah, I think I'm the opposite of growing up in an entrepreneurial household.
Right. And so the first one was Engine 5, and that basically made websites for companies?
We did that in 1997, which was the really the start of the first dot-com bubble. we made websites. We focused on e-commerce. We made some of the very first e-commerce stores back when that was like non-trivial to like make something that you can like put stuff in a shopping cart and check out. So we made a bunch of those for like eToys and Nokia and things like that. But yeah, those were good days. I remember Sun Microsystems at that point. Their slogan was Sun. We put the dot in .com. They ran TV ads saying we put the dot in .com, and we immediately made T-shirts that say Engine 5. We put the colon in http://. It didn't catch.
That's
on
a good
much.
Nerd joke,
isn't it? Yeah.
And then you sold that company.
Sold it to Vignette, which was a big public company in Austin, Texas, that made content management software.
$25 million or something like that.
26 or something like that. Yeah, which was great. We never had any money before then. We didn't have investors, so it was just like. It was just us because we literally, when we started Engine 5, we didn't know that investors existed. I mean, I knew about stockbrokers, but I didn't know that there were like these people that would give you money to start a company. We were all just engineers. You know, we were profitable from day one. We basically like brought our computers to an office and started working, and people started paying us because back then that was easy. And when we sold it, $26 million, yeah, it was just us. And so it was the first time any of us, you know, had seen any money. It was a worthwhile experience.
And then you started another company.
Started our second company a month after September 11th. So it was October 11th of 2001 is when we started the second company. It felt like we wanted to do something much more substantive. You know, we kind of looked back on all the stuff we'd done up until then, and we were like, yeah, e-commerce and recommendations, like all of it is so trivial. Like there's got to be something more important in life after September 11th. We teamed up with this mad scientist, like brilliant, crazy, entrepreneurial MIT professor, Sylvia McCauley, and we started Core Street, which was a government security cryptography company. We wanted to like change the way that everyone thought about security, and ran that for about 7 years, and then sold that company as well.
And then that brings you to Evernote.
Yeah, and then after that, we were sitting around and thinking, well, what are we going to do next? A lot of the same people. So a lot of this is...
Yeah, so you kind of traveled with your team, basically.
Yeah, and it kind of grew a little bit. You know, every company, like, we try to bring the best people from the previous one. You know, a few people burn out. You know, a few new people get added. So, yeah, but similar team. So we sat around and we kind of said, okay, like, what lessons did we learn from the first two companies and what do we want to do now? And what we'd never done before is build something for ourselves. So Evernote has an interesting history. There was two teams that joined forces in 2007. So I'd had a team that was right after Core Street where we decided to work on human memory extension. We wanted to make an external brain. You know, all of us want to feel smarter, more productive. The current productivity tools hadn't changed. You know, typewriters inside of a computer. It was like Microsoft Office, that kind of stuff. And we thought, okay, there's got to be something better. So we started thinking about how do we improve like human memory, human cognition? How do we actually make like modern productivity stuff? And we wanted to do something on mobile. We were like, you know, we've been building apps for phones for years, but we finally had the insight that like, okay, now it's going to go mainstream. Like this is when it's actually going to make sense.
Like AI today.
Yeah, like AI today. Like that was the very strong feeling. So we were in Boston. There was another team in California that was headed up by Stepan Pachikov, who was this brilliant Russian-American scientist, inventor, entrepreneur. And he had his team. And his team was actually the team that way back in like the late 80s, Apple like brought over to do the Apple Newton. The real nerds remember the Apple Newton. It was like the first tablet.
It was like the pre-Palm Pilot.
Yeah. It had like handwriting recognition. It was like amazingly cool and advanced for its time. Stepan and his team had been here working on like basically, to them, they were working on like version 5.0 of what they tried to do with the Newton. And then Stepan and I met over at this really bad sushi restaurant in Cupertino and then just decided, let's just like join forces and do this together.
It wasn't really bad sushi, was it? As in like...
No.
It was gastrointestinal issues.
Well, yeah, no, it was just uninspired. But for sushi, that's like the worst sin.
It was
uninspired conveyor belt sushi. But it was a great conversation. And so we came together in 07. And the idea was just... we want to make you smarter. We want to make the modern version of tools that make you smarter, more productive, and thereby happier. We were just lucky. We got a lot of the timing right, and it took off.
I remember reading the headlines. Evernote was one of the first unicorns of the mobile era.
Yeah, I think like when the word unicorn got coined, we were like, yeah, we were one. It was us and maybe Dropbox or something. That was, yeah. And it was, I always remember thinking of what a stupid, you know, idea this was, but yeah.
What worked? Why was it, how much of it was just luck?
I mean, a lot of it is luck. there's plenty of people in companies that like are just as smart and worked harder and like just doesn't catch on. So a ton of it was luck, and primarily, you know, it's timing is the other thing. So we got the timing right. And I think we were prepared to take advantage of the luck and the timing when it happened. And so we moved quickly as we realized like, oh man, this was a good break. Now let's like jump on this. So like, I remember we had our first product, this is like Windows and Mac desktop, you know, tool. And we were playing around with things on phones, but the iPhone had just come out, but there was no apps on it yet. Because the first year there was no apps on the iPhone. I remember getting a call from an executive at Apple and, they're like, so, you know, we really like your product on the Mac. A bunch of people use it. And we're wondering if you want to, like, participate in this new thing we're doing for the iPhone. And I'm like, yeah, definitely. What do you got? And I said, well, we're thinking of, like, making a store for applications on the iPhone. We're thinking of, like, calling it an app store. And, you know, we'll let developers make apps for the phone. And, you know, we'd like you to be on there at launch day. Is that something you'd be interested in developing? And I'm like, yes, this is definitely something you'd be interested in developing. When do you need to buy? And they were like we're going to launch it next Thursday. And it was like, you know, Tuesday. So I'm like, oh, okay, 8 days. Yeah, we can do that. So then, you know, we didn't sleep for 8 days. I mean, like, wrote the first version of Evernote.
Did you realize then what the App Store could be?
Yeah, I mean, we thought that it was going to be as big as it got. We really did. Now, we could have been totally wrong. So it's not like we were like geniuses for thinking it. But yeah, like the potential to me at least was like, I was very, very highly confident. Now, I've been highly confident about all sorts of stuff that didn't come to pass. But in this particular case, I was like highly confident that it worked out exactly like we thought.
You guys moved out here. You moved out here from
Boston. Yeah, so I moved the whole team from Boston to here. And then we hooked up with Stepan's team and we started this company. And then we almost went out of business like 3 times because we kept running out of money, and fundraising was terrible.
See, I read that you guys raised a boatload of money.
I think almost $400 million total.
Yeah. But you almost went out of business?
The first $5 million took more work than the other $395. So, in the beginning, it was super hard. Well, neither of us was really very good at raising money. I had raised some money for my second company, but that was in Boston. It doesn't count. It doesn't count for Silicon Valley. It doesn't count. We just had a terrible pitch. You know, we would come into a VC and I would say, I am Phil Libin and, you know, you never heard of me. We're making this software that's going to let you write stuff down.
It's an extension of your brain. It's going to be great.
Yeah, and we're going to give it away for free. And then it would be like, oh, so who's your competition? And I would say like, well, every computer or phone or PDA that's ever come out already has a pretty good free note-taking app on it. So I guess it's a sort of everyone is our competition already. It wasn't the best pitch. No one gave us money here in Silicon Valley, so we wound up raising money. Well, Stepan and I had both sold companies before, so we were able to support, you know, fund it a little bit ourselves, and we had friends and family. So it was literally a lot of friends and family. And then we got some angel investors, but all of our initial money all came from like unconventional sources. So we had money from Docomo, which is the big Japanese telecom company. We had money from these like Alberta oil barons.
How do you find these people?
Just, you know,
desperation.
Well, I mean, you just look.
You Google them.
A lot of them came to us because they were all Evernote users to some point. We got the product. We got a product out pretty early, and
so you kind of found some fanboys.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Actually, all of the money we took, almost $400 million, we never took a penny from someone who wasn't an Evernote fan. Even the late stage institutional money. Everyone was like a giant user first and a big fan first. So we actually never took money from someone who wasn't in love with the product. But definitely if it wasn't for that, we would never have gotten started because all of our early money only people who like
saw the utility of it.
Yeah. And I didn't have to explain it to them. Like they just grokked it immediately because I was terrible at explaining it. But then I got a little bit better at it. But you know, yeah.
Was there one key person or one key backer in those early days that kept you from folding?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, we almost went out of business. I think it was like October of 2008. It was fall of 2008. And we had been working to raise $10 million. We had a term sheet. But then because we had this complicated, weird structure, because we merged two companies and everything, should never do that again, just for the complexity's sake, we'll just start over. It took about 6 months of due diligence to like get all the legal stuff like ironed out. So we were in due diligence for 6 months, but it was going to be fine because, you know, we were going to get $10 million on the other side of it. It was a European investor. And on the day that we were supposed to close and get $10 million was the day that like the markets just collapsed. I think like Merrill Lynch went out of business and like the, you know, the markets were down. This was like the giant meltdown.
This was in the midst of the market meltdown.
At the heart of the market meltdown. And the day we were going to close was the worst day of it. And on closing day, the investor said, called me up and said, we just lost 60% of our portfolio value. We're pulling out of the investment. You know, it's just like sheer panic, right? Because at this point, we had like 3 weeks of cash left in the bank. You know, I stayed up. I called everyone I knew. Like, no one would even like take phone calls. No one would like respond to any emails, take any phone calls. Sequoia had just sent out the RIP Good Times memo of 2008 that like told all their companies, like, you're never going to raise money again. It was like, it was the worst of the meltdown. And we had 3 weeks of cash left. So I scrambled for a week, made zero headway. Meantime, like all of my personal portfolio was like down to basically zero. So it was just like, it was bad times. Traumatic experience. And then a week later, I remember sitting there, it was like 3 a.m. And I remember deciding like, okay, we've got 2 weeks of cash left tomorrow. And I'm going to go to sleep now. And then tomorrow I have to go to the office and shut down the company. Because you know, you can't go to zero. You have to like pay some final bills.
Because how many people did you have at that point?
20-ish.
Right.
Maybe like 25. So it was already like significant, right? But I'm like, all right, I have to go tell people like, this is the last paycheck and you know, we're done. I'm sorry. And I was ready to do it. Like I was totally prepared. I'm going to go to sleep, going to wake up. And I remember thinking, this is what it must feel like to be an adult. Like this is my first like adult moment. And I remember thinking like, this sucks. Like after this, I'm never being an adult again.
It sucks to be a grown up.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to do this ever again. And then right before going to bed, I got this email and it's just from some random Swedish guy. And it just said, I am a random Swedish guy. And, you know, I just want you to know that I love Evernote. I've been using it for a few months and it's really changed my life and like made me so much more organized and productive. And it's great. And I remember like feeling a little bit better. I'm like, oh, it's nice. Cause you know, if you like make the difference in the life of one Swede, you've accomplished something. And then he went on to say, so I'm just writing to see if you're like looking for any investment. And so I wrote back at like 3:10 a.m. I'm like, why? Yes, we are looking for investment. And then I hit send and I didn't go to sleep. And then 20 minutes later, I was on a Skype call with him. And 2 weeks after that, he wired us $500,000.
Who is this random Swedish guy?
So we've never disclosed him. So he's a real person. He's asked to like not be disclosed, but he's a real person. He like saved the company. Like
Swedish guardian angel.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who just loved Evernote and happened to have $500,000 that he didn't mind, you know, investing.
As one does.
Yeah. Saved the company completely. And even that's like, that's just luck. I mean, it's like, it's having made a decent product. It's being up at 3 a.m. But at the end of the day, like, it's also like this person happened. And had I gone to bed 10 minutes earlier, it probably wouldn't have responded to that email. Because, you know, I'd have woken up and driven to the office and closed it down. I wouldn't have been like reading through random emails. So stuff like that happens all the time.
Wow.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So you get your 500 grand, you live to fight another day, and then you go on to raise all of this money, and you're a unicorn, and everybody's talking about you guys are going to go public. And then, like, you get to 2015, and there's, like, Evernote, the first dead unicorn. There's all these headlines that say you guys are toast. What happened?
Well, that's just hype cycle. So there wasn't actually events there. That's just, like, you know, if you're going to be super popular and you're going to be the darling for a while, then it's going to come around and, you know, you're going to get torn down and then you're going to be popular again. So that is something that we anticipated, and it wasn't that big a deal. At that point, the fundamentals of the business were good, but everything was slowing down. Like, and it was harder and harder to like raise more money. Like, things were starting to slow. And I remember back then saying, like, thinking, this is why I kind of hated the whole unicorn stuff to begin with, because like it was obvious from the start that we were going to end up here. And it definitely made like recruiting harder. It made retention harder. Morale really suffered because of that. So it was, you know, it was very much
because
like
of what? Because of the negative press or
the whole cycle of like having gone from hyper growth and everyone loves you and you're like you're in the ray of sunshine to now you're not that anymore. But because you're not that anymore, it's like now it's like grossly exaggerated the other way. Now it's like you're failing and everything's going wrong. And
because you had gone from zero to what, 150 million customers, right?
Yeah. And then I think when I left, it was like 200 million, and it's more than that now, I think. But I don't. When you retain sanity, when you go from hyper growth to like sanity, it feels terrible, right? Because you're no longer like the best thing ever. So it was hard. I mean, it's not like it was the media's fault. It was like that whole cycle of just like going from massive hype to reality. It's like a big slowdown. And, you know, the Silicon Valley culture doesn't do anything. Like, there's never the correct amount of reaction, right? Everything is overreaction or underreaction. So, obviously, if you're going to go from being too much, the next step is to be too little. You're not going to ever be, you know, the porridge is never going to be just right. The bed's never going to be just right.
Just thinking about that kind of that cycle, the up and then the downslope. I mean, you were continuing to grow, but was it a question of, had you tried to do too much?
There's just a lot of bad habits that get baked into the system when you grow that fast. For one, like almost everyone in an executive role, with one or two, you know, exceptions of like actually competent people that we had hired, like for almost all of us at Evernote, myself included, Evernote was like ridiculously the biggest thing that we'd ever done. Like the current jobs that we were in were the biggest jobs we've ever had, which is kind of terrifying. I mean, it's great, but it's also like, if that's literally true of everyone, it's kind of scary. So there was definitely a time where we were like, okay, we need to actually bring some people in who know what they're doing at big company scale. How does that change the culture? So these are all like, these are the growing things that you have to, you know, that you have to wrestle with. And wrestling with those in the spotlight is tough.
And you left in 2015.
The original plan was, right from the beginning, I talked about Evernote as a 100-year startup. We kept saying 100-year startup. You know, we wanted something that outlives us. And I would say part of that means that I have to find the next CEO. Like, it's my job to find the person who's going to be a better CEO, because I can't be a CEO for 100 years. Don't want to be. I was comfortable with that idea, but I never put a time on it. I didn't know if that was like in 6 months or in 20 years. And so around 2015, I talked to the board and I decided like, okay, it's time to like find a successor. So let's hire a president. I would stay on as CEO, and then we would have someone kind of run day-to-day operations for a year or two. And then I would, you know, then this person would become the CEO. So we did a president search, but we just couldn't, like, it's very hard. It's much harder to recruit a president than a CEO. Like, the really impressive people just want to be CEO. So after doing that for a year, we said, fine, let's just find a CEO. And then the CEO will come in and run all the kind of business stuff, data operations. And I was still hoping, and the plan was that I would stay involved with the product. Like, I would be the executive chairman. I would kind of head up the product thinking. And so we found a great CEO, Chris. And then, you know, it just turned out like that me staying sharply involved just wasn't going to work. It was just like way too awkward. I wound up leaving as CEO, I think, in 2015. And then I stepped down as the executive chairman about a year ago. So I think, sometime in 2016.
And then you became a venture capitalist.
Yes, I became a VC when I left as CEO for 2 years. I was a managing director at General Catalyst, and I was kind of thinking, well, I'll get my like hands-on product fix from doing product stuff at Evernote, and I would get my like big thinking investment broad view fix from being a VC. That was kind of the plan.
How was it going from the entrepreneur who has to go out and talk to now people like you on the other side of the table who have the money and are trying to pick the winners?
It was great and weird. Food was better, you know. You know, I'd obviously been around VCs for basically what feels like my whole life at this point, but always either as an angel investor or as an entrepreneur, and this was like kind of being on the other side. And in many ways, it's the best job in the world. Like, just literally, like, it's an amazing job. You're literally just paid to learn as much as possible about interesting subjects. And you can talk to anyone, like anyone, everyone wants to talk with you. And so like, it's great. If you're just like intellectually curious, you're motivated by learning, you want to like be around talented people, like it's the greatest job in the world. To me, it felt like none of that was actually doing anything. Like it wasn't like that to me didn't register in my brain as work. And like, I wanted to be a bit more hands-on, which I thought I would be at Evernote, but that didn't work out. And so I was just kind of adjusting to saying, okay, well maybe at this point, you know, I don't actually need to be hands-on. I can just do the VC thing. And then right around, like basically on election day, like with this election in November is when I decided, okay, like, no, I still need to do something that's like more actively positive for the world. I kind of decided if like one more, like let's actually build something, not just invest.
So how did the election change your approach to investing, especially when you talk about, you know, Trump, the kind of narrative he sold was, oh, our jobs are going overseas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when really most of those jobs have been eliminated by automation, and AI and automation go hand in hand.
So I'm not a political person. There's this moment that probably everyone who's relatively smart has at some point, probably pretty young. Like, I think I remember the first time this happened to me when I was a kid. You kind of have this experience where, like, there are no adults, where you sort of realize, like, oh, right, there is nobody else. You know, maybe like in college or something. And up until then, you're like, well, I'm just a kid, but there's all these like smart people who like actually know what they're doing and they're taking care of something. And then at some point you're just like, no, that's it. There's no actual smart, competent people. Like, it's just, everyone is kind of equally clueless and it's just sort of all us on the planet doing stuff. And so I just had that realization like in spades where like, for years, I've been like very much enthusiastic about AI and automation and self-driving cars and all of this stuff. And I was like, yeah, of course, I know it's going to make massive social disruption and people are going to lose a lot of jobs. And like, that's important. But like, that's not my job to think about. Like, there's adults who think about that stuff.
Government, someone else will think about that, right?
Like, yeah, that'll take care of itself. And then somewhere around election day, I had that feeling again where I'm like, nope, there's no adults. It's our job to think about all of it. And so let's just start thinking about it. And I really didn't like the fact that it seemed at that point that the world was just like closing in. Like, I'm very much a, you know, international person. I love traveling. We did a ton of it at Evernote. I have like built many awesome things in different countries. Like, I wanted that to continue. So I kind of thought we need to have like a more active answer for a positive vision of the most talented people everywhere in the world doing cool things together. It just wasn't happening. I wanted to be more active in doing that.
What was your worst day of work? We won't count the first your $500 startup, but in four companies.
Yeah. I mean, we had some bad days. The day that I thought I'd have to shut down Evernote was pretty bad. I guess I was at home at the time, so it wasn't really at work. I remember at Evernote, I forget exactly when, it was a few years ago, but we detected that there was a big hacking attempt, that we were being hacked. To respond, we wound deciding to sort of take the maximum possible response, which is we shut the whole system down and we deactivated every password and we forced everyone to like make new passwords to sign in just because like we couldn't guarantee that passwords hadn't been stolen.
That's a pretty big move for...
It was big and like we had to make that decision within like a few minutes and that was very hard because I knew what that would mean. It was basically like, you know, we had at least 100 million users at that point. It was like pulling the plug on a running computer and then like plugging it back in and like watching it boot up again and hoping that it all boots correctly. But
hoping 100 million people choose to reboot.
Yeah. And we knew we would lose users and we did. It was super painful. And then we had to work for, you know, weeks just to make sure that everything was plugged and we got a bunch of bad press about it. But it was the right decision. And then And then nobody else did it, which was really pissed me off. Because like afterwards, like 10 other companies got hacked, and many of them didn't even disclose it, let alone, I don't think anyone like literally reset all the passwords. And that's what keeps these things going. So we like, feel like we did the right thing. We like paid the price for it. And then like everyone else was like, we're just not going to take it as seriously. But that was very, that was tough. There was a lot of bad press that was, you know, just personally difficult. But look, on balance, like, if I compared the good days and the bad days, it's like overwhelmingly good days. So, you know, at one point I got like relatively prominent as, you know, as a CEO at Evernote. And then once that happened, I started getting invited to like all of these, you know, CEO dinners.
You're
like,
on the list.
Yeah. I'd hang out with, you know, fancy people with, you know, that were actually much more important than I was. And whenever there's like a dinner and there's like a bunch of like high-end CEOs sitting around a table, inevitably, if it was just the CEOs, inevitably what would happen is at some point someone would be like, ah, you know, being a CEO, it's really lonely. And the person next to me would be like, yeah, it's really lonely. And like, no one really understands. And it's like, it's difficult and it's really lonely. And then it would like go around the table. And the next person would be like, yeah, yeah, really lonely, very lonely. And then it would just go around the table and it would get to me. And I would be like, boy, yeah, it's really lonely and it's difficult. But it beats having a job, right? Like, it beats working. And, you know, everyone would laugh. And, like, that's kind of how I feel about it. Like, yeah, there's many terrible days, but, like, it beats working. It's still the best thing in the world.
And just circling back to All Turtles, where does that come from?
Ah, so it's from Turtles All the Way Down. So it's a Bertrand Russell, I think, Bertrand Russell reference. The idea is Bertrand Russell is giving a lecture about, like, the structure of the Earth and the solar system and... Afterwards, everyone claps, but well, the way the story goes, this old lady gets up, because all old stories are horribly misogynist. So an old lady gets up and says, ah, what you said is all wrong. Everyone knows that the Earth is actually you know, resting on the back of an elephant, which is standing on the back of a giant turtle. And Bertrand Russell says, well, if that's true, madam, then what's the turtle standing on? And the woman says, ah, everyone knows that. It's Turtles All the Way Down. So that's the reference. So it's the idea is right. It's... whatever you build, you are standing on the shoulders of the people who came before you. You're helping the next generation. It's, you know, it's Turtles All the Way Down. Plus, elephants stand on turtles. So it was like the obvious sequel to me after Evernote.
And one of the companies I saw that's here is Do Not Pay, which I think, is that a British company?
Yeah.
They basically help you get out of parking tickets?
Well, it started with parking tickets. It's an AI robot. It's a robot lawyer, an AI lawyer, and starts challenging parking tickets. But really, it's a bureaucracy fighter. So the idea is, like, the little guy is really victimized by bureaucracy. Parking tickets, fines, landlord disputes, like, all the stuff. Like, if I get it, it's fine because, like, you know, I have lawyers and I know how to deal with it. It doesn't threaten me. But, you know, the little person gets it and they're just, like, they're really victimized. They don't do it in time. There's fees. They don't know how to respond. It's, like, a major, very significant thing. So that now, you know, when you get hassled by bureaucracy, instead of, like, you dealing with it, you let the robot deal with it. And it turns out robots are great at bureaucracy, like much better than your landlord is. So I think it's a brilliant insight. And we've got that's a common theme at All Turtles. Like, we want to build things that favors like the little over the big. Like, we want to favor the deserving over the established. Like, almost everything we do has that element. And then when we free these people from having to like convince us that it could be a $10 billion outcome, which it could be, but don't really care, and you know, they don't have to worry about how to make companies and make all of the stupid but very difficult company mistakes. They just focus on making important products. Like, we think we can move the world forward a little bit that way.
If you had one piece of advice to give 25-year-old Phil about doing what you're doing, starting businesses, etc.
If I had a time machine and I could like go back in time and like talk to 25-year-old Phil, it's like first thing I'd say is I'd be like, dude, just don't worry about it, because in 25 years, you're going to have a time machine. It's all going to be okay. And then probably the second piece of advice is I would be like, build Evernote first, like build it before the first two companies, like do the thing that you want before doing the thing that you think other people may want.
Why?
Because I think like the world is so much more of a meritocracy at this point, especially, well, at least the tech world, meaning that like, because of social media, because you have almost perfect information sharing, if you build a product that's really great, like everyone's going to know about it and there's basically no friction to getting it. It just wasn't the case, you know, a long time ago when you could build a mediocre product and just really double down on the marketing and distribution. Like here, you really can't. So the most important thing to do is to build a great product and do it as quickly as possible. So how are you going to do that? Well, especially if it's your first one, you're much more likely to build, to make it great if you're building it for yourself, because then at least you have like a very efficient testing cycle. As long as you can be honest, like as long as you know it's getting better every day, you can iterate much faster. When we were building things for, you know, for big banks and governments, like we would release a product and then how would we know whether it got better? You know, we'd have to wait for a year to get product feedback. So like our cycles were a year. At Evernote, our cycles were like, you know, 2 hours. We could like build something, and if it didn't feel right, we would change it. And if it didn't feel right, we would change it, because we didn't have to wait a year to like gather feedback, because it was for us. So I think very practically, like if you build something for yourself, it's going to get to great faster than if you build for something not yourself, because you can iterate faster and that's your best chance of success. So I think
so. Something that you're actually interested in, rather than like, I am going to make a company that someone will find useful. I have to kind of just figure out what that is.
Do something that you yourself, especially your first company, later you should, you know, go on and do other stuff, but like the first one, I would say do something that that's for where you are the target audience, so that you know when the product is actually getting better, so that you can iterate on it faster. Also have a time machine.
And that's it for another episode. A big thank you to Phil, who I was impressed with before. I mean, he founded Evernote. But the fact that he founded and sold his first company at 16 is pretty cool. When I was 16, I was making sandwiches at Togo's for $4.75 an hour. But hey, he made computers, I made sandwiches, and we both end up in San Francisco talking about artificial intelligence. The world is a wonderful place. I do have one request. If you like what you're hearing, please stop into Apple Podcasts. Give us a rating and review. It helps other people find us and generally helps the cause. So just take a minute. I'd really appreciate it. And that is all. Until next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.